Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Good morning. Frederick.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Backer. Baker.
Baker here.
Becker Finn.
Present.
Hansen.
Present.
Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Lippert.
Lippert, present.
Mohler.
Present.
Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Thompson. All right, we have a quorum.
Okay, quorum is present. Our first agenda is approval of the minutes from last Wednesday, February 3rd. Are there any questions or corrections of the minutes? Not seeing any hands. Representative Frederick, would you move the approval of the minutes from February 3rd, 2021?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves approval of the minutes for February 3rd, 2021. Please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes stand approved. Members, we are not taking any official action on any bills today, but we're going to have a pair of discussions that will involve legislative proposals we expect to see in some form before the division later this session. We are going to start with a presentation on the Epidemic Response Advisory Council, which was created through landmark legislation we passed in the last biennium. Today, we have Representatives Baker and Kogel are the appointees of the council, and they're both with us today. I've asked them to provide us with an update of the work that's been done by the council so far, as well as a preview of the legislative recommendations that the council has put forward for this biennium. I'm budgeting about 45 minutes for this discussion, so as we have time for the second item that we have on the agenda. With that, I would like to welcome Representative Cagle and Baker and would welcome them to start the presentation. So I'm not too sure which of you will start first, if you'd like to go ahead.
Sir, just want to let you know that I'm here, Representative Baker.
Okay, thank you, Representative Baker, for letting us know. We'll make sure that the attendance reflects you being here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll kick it off if I could. Representative Dave Baker. And thank you. And again, we're going to hopefully spend about 25, 30 minutes talking about this, but we want to leave a lot of time for questions for members. This is a huge issue that has been worked on for a number of years. And when I arrived here 6 years ago, it was starting to move with back in the day of folks working on getting naloxone, which you might have heard of, called it Narcan, out to first responders. That is a life-saving drug that does the reversing effects of an opioid overdose. I got into that very kind of late conversation when I first arrived here. And for some of those of you that don't know, my son Dan passed away on March 9th, 2011. We'll be hitting that 10-year anniversary coming up here in actually just a matter of weeks. And it's an amazing journey to kind of fight and work hard on something that you should felt like you should have known more at the time, and we didn't. So that really propelled me into this world of figuring out what the heck happened here. And I want to just give you a tiny bit of background and how we got to this opioid council that I am so proud to be a part of. And then we're going to flip it over to Representative Cagle and our chair, Dr. Ann Pilkus. People have asked me, what in the world happened here? How did we get to that point when opioids started screaming out of control? Because opioids have been a very important part of medicine for decades. We need this pain medicine when you need it for acute issues and post-surgery and things like that. I don't want people to think that there isn't a place for this in medicine. What happened was in 1995, the FDA approved the first time ever a time-released opioid capsule. And a company called Purdue Pharmaceutical brought it to them and had, and I think really literally kind of tricked the FDA to say, this is going to be the next best thing. And it is going to take care of pain. We should have been able to manage pain better. And that was also the same time that this pain number thing came up. If you've ever been in your doctor's office and you see the charts up there with the smiley faces and the sad faces, doctors then were required by law to ask you, oh, by the way, what's your pain level today? You might not even be in there for anything to do with pain, but it all started to come together with this perfect storm. And doctors, providers, everyone was just told that this was going to take care of everybody's pain. We should be able to manage pain better. Well, we now know that, you know, this has got us into a real problem. Thousands and thousands of American lives were lost because of this sometimes simple misdiagnosis, or taking a, in my son's case, a bad back and creating a thing that was totally out of control in about a year and a half. We couldn't just take him off, because when you go into withdrawal with opioids, it is something that you never want to see somebody go through. My work on this bill and this concept was really started about 4, 5, 6 years ago. It was to try and find a way to find money that we could get through licensing reform in the state of Minnesota, because pharmaceutical companies were paying $265 to have a license to sell as many drugs as you want to in the state of Minnesota. We thought that that was wrong, and we actually reformed this, and we were looking for about $20 million to help into an account that would be focused on getting help and grants and education, first responder updates, Narcan. We wanted to have a secure fund to try to help people in the state of Minnesota. So after about really 3-4 years of banging our heads, clashing with pharmaceutical manufacturers and companies, we finally got there. And I will tell you, I could not have gotten it there without the help of my friend, Representative Liz Olson. She helped me get it through the finish line. Senator Rosen and Senator Eaton were also our co-authors in the Senate. And we were one of the first states in the country that reformed the way we look at this to do a licensing fee reform. Now, we are actually collecting about $14 million a year for this through licensing. Larger companies pay more than smaller companies, and if you sell opioids, you're going to pay a lot more than if you don't sell opioids to the state of Minnesota. Again, we're just saying that there's a cost to this to our society. So we've got some money to work with. We're one of the first in the country to establish what's called the Opioid Stewardship Fund, so that all this money will go into the stewardship fund, not into the general fund. It does not have to be appropriated every year by the legislature. It just goes into this fund. The Opioid Council that you will be hearing from our chair in a few minutes here will kind of explain how we're using that dollars, how we've had to stand our bill up and our council up to kind of make sure that we've got the right bylaws and the rules and the right members on this thing. But you know, when we wrote this bill, it was meant to really get to every corner of the state, to every community of color, Native American communities, rural, urban. Half our meetings, when we are meeting in person, have to happen in rural Minnesota. And so we actually really thought this all through very carefully. I am really proud that we've got people from corrections on this council. We've got folks, again, legislators. We have people in recovery. We've got family members. We've got folks that really understand this. And we've got addiction medicine doctors, and our relationship with the Minnesota Department of Health and DHS has been very good. And we are working through a lot of issues to kind of stand up a very complex situation here of how we actually help people. So again, this story of Minnesotan and how we have led the country on this is getting a lot of national recognition. You'll start to hear some lawsuits that are being awarded here. Recently, there was a McKinsey marketing firm that was just agreed to a $587 million fine for the country. Minnesota will receive around $8 million for this. And as this starts to come in, our language is any awards won by the state of Minnesota will go back into this stewardship fund. Again, it's not going to get absorbed by the general fund. This council is responsible to do the right thing with this funding. We've got more settlements coming. It's a very small thing to feel like we're making a difference when you have lost somebody. And again, what is good about these lawsuits that are coming is that they are also not allowing the non-disclosures to be a part of this. So when we find out what happened, nothing will be kept in the safe. We are going to get all the facts. We're going to understand what happened. Purdue Pharmaceutical or the Sackler family are the privately owned folks that actually owned Purdue, and which had the drug called OxyContin. And they're the ones who really kind of poured the fuel on the fire. So you're going to see billions of dollars of coming out to the country, and it's a lot to talk about. But I want to just say how proud I am to be part of the Opioid Council. It's been a lot of work. This meant to be a quarterly meeting at the beginning. It has turned into a monthly meeting because we have so much to do to kind of build up this program. And our purpose is very much to help families and help our communities understand and how we can actually help deploy some funds and resources and give them direction. So with that, Mr. Chair and others, again, if you have questions after this, I, as a member of the House, always want to talk to members who want a more of a deeper dive into this issue. It's important to me to share the story, but it's important to me to share that when I am no longer here too, this needs to continue on, because even through this pandemic that we're facing, opioids are still out there. They're killing people more than ever. And again, you're going to see some information today that's pretty startling. And so we'll go through that. And I think with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to either, I think, Representative Cagle or our chair. So I'll see who's going to go next. Thank you.
I think probably Representative Cagle, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, Representative Baker's son's story could have easily been my story. I had major back problems as a teenager, and was put on an excessive amount of pain medications throughout my 20s. And so, and then not only that, but then I had a brother who also became addicted to heroin after having an appendectomy and getting pain medication as well, and then moved to street drugs. And so it was pretty scary. But so what I just like to invite our MDH, Dana Farley, and our DHS, Boyd Brown, to present some statistics on what's going on right now in the opioid, with the Opioid Council. And then Dr. Pilkus will kind of share what we've been doing the past, year and a half here now. And then at the end, I will share some of the policy recommendations that that we have been working on. So with that, I.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Appreciate it. So we'll go on to, I believe you're mentioning Mr. Brown from the Department of Human Services. We'll start with some of the statistics and stuff. Is that correct, Representative Cagle? Or will be
Mr. Chair, I believe it'll be Mr. Farley from MDH.
Okay, certainly. Thank you. Mr. Farley, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your presentation, please.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Dana Farley. I am the supervisor for the Drug Overdose Prevention Unit in the Department of Health Injury and Violence Prevention Section. I forwarded slides to the committee, I believe. I don't know if you can share those. Yes. Okay. I just have four brief slides. This first slide here shows the cumulative weekly drug overdose deaths in Minnesota. And this is the total number of drug overdoses, not just opioids, but all drugs. And unfortunately, in 2020, we have a record number at 959 right now. It may go up for 2020, but it'll just be probably less than a dozen or so. Unfortunately, that is a 27% increase over last year. One of the things, if you take a look at about week 20, March or so, it really starts to diverge from previous years there and continues. And so 2020 was a difficult year in so many ways, and unfortunately for overdoses. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, if we just take a look at opioids, this slide is about opioid-involved deaths. And one of the things that is happening is if you take a look at the green line, it shows the dramatic increase from 2019 to 2020. This huge increase in opioid overdose is being fueled by synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl And we see this represents a change in the epidemic as we go from prescription medication and pills in the previous years to more synthetic, and it also part of it is counterfeit pills and drugs and much more deadlier form. Next slide, please. This third slide, as Representative Baker and Cagle mentioned, is that there are disparities in the overdoses. The dark blue line represents deaths, overdose deaths, American Indians in Minnesota, and that is almost seven times more in 2019 than for white Minnesotans. That has been increasing, unfortunately, as you go over the years, and has particularly hit these communities. African Americans or Black Minnesotans have about twice as much overdose deaths as white Minnesotans, and unfortunately, that is one of the highest in the nation. So the overdose death disparities for American Indians is the highest in the nation, and that of African Americans or Black Minnesotans is one of the highest disparities also in the nation. And finally, the next slide, fourth slide, this final slide. As Representative Baker talked about, this started out with prescription pills and goes, you know, beyond 2015. But one of the things that the legislature and the work being done with the opioid prescribing work group is about better pain management prescribing. And what this green line shows is the decrease in the overall prescription rate per 1,000 Minnesotans, and the bars show the decreased amount of the opioid prescriptions. So as Representative Baker said, there is an appropriate role for pain medication, and we see that, but there are changes. And I'll just briefly say one example. In the past, dentists were one of the most highly prescribing opioid prescribers in Minnesota, and they changed their practice. A couple years ago, I had my son get their wisdom teeth taken out. The doctor didn't know what I did for a living, and he said to my son, who's a teenager, and this is often, as Representative Cagle and another said, teens are often the first exposure. And the doctor said, let's talk about pain management, wound management. Try this dressing on here, try some ibuprofen and Tylenol. I'll give your parents a prescription, but if you don't need it, don't fill it. And there's a good example of focusing on better pain management. And with that, I'll close or stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farley. Not seeing any questions at this moment doesn't mean they're not going to pop up. We will next move on to Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown, if you'd like to identify yourself, who you're with, and start your presentation, please.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Brown might be here just to answer questions. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you, Representative Cagle, for getting me straightened out there. Appreciate it. Then we would go to Dr. Plykos, then for the presentation as the chair of the committee.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all the representatives. I'm happy to be here today to talk about the Opioid Council and a lot of the good work that we've been doing. And thank you, Representative Baker and Cagle, for inviting me today and letting me share some of this great work.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Real quick, if you could also identify yourself. This is for the voice record, so that if somebody's listening to a video of it, they'll know who's speaking right now.
Great. Yes, so my name is Ann Pilkus, and I am the chair of the Opioid Council, and I'm an addiction medicine physician. I represent the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine on the council. I just want to reiterate some of the things that Representative Cagle and Representative Baker and Mr. Farley were saying. As an addiction medicine physician that's like in the field every day, you know, these numbers just look like numbers to, you know, and bar graphs. But for me, you know, I have a panel of patients that I see, and I have, you know, new patients coming in every day, and I see, you know, I go to homeless shelters, and I see people that are in active addiction. And I can tell you that I've been doing this for about 10 years as an addiction medicine physician. And in those 10 years, before 2020, I have had 3 people that I, in my patient panel, overdose since 2012-ish. And this year I've had 2, just in 2020, beginning of 2021. And, you know, they were people that were both actually really close to me, and the pandemic, you know, patients that I've known for a long time, and the pandemic just was too much. And so, you know, I think it's, as a physician, you create relationships with patients, and so it becomes personal. I think for so many people here and on the council, it's a personal issue, just like Representative Cagle and Representative Baker were talking about. You know, Mr. Farley showed in those graphs, there's been a 30% increase in overdose deaths since 2020, or since, and that the interesting part of that increase where it diverged in about March is, we all know what happened in March, right? March is when the pandemic really hit and all of the restrictions were put in place. And so that increase in overdose deaths means that we really cannot take our eyes off this ball. Yes, the prescription rate is decreasing dramatically, but, you know, we've created this problem and it's not going away. It's getting worse. So the other thing that I think is really important to know from a practitioner standpoint is the fentanyl issue. Fentanyl is much more powerful than heroin. And so, and it's flooding the streets right now. I don't think people think they're using heroin and they're really using fentanyl or some sort of mix of it. I think most people right now who are using drugs are using fentanyl, and they either don't know it or they do know it. But it's everywhere. And it's, like I said, it's much stronger than heroin. And so that has a lot of repercussions. It's much easier to overdose. It's harder to reverse an overdose. So you need, you know, more than one Narcan or naloxone to reverse an overdose. Sometimes you need 3, 4, even 5 to reverse an overdose. And, you know, the kits that people send out have 2 in them. So it's, you know, even if you have Narcan, it might not work. The withdrawal from fentanyl is a lot worse because it's so much more powerful. So people have less motivation to stop, you know, not that withdrawal from heroin is any, you know, fun time, but the withdrawal from fentanyl is much worse. And once you do stop, because it's so much stronger, you have much worse cravings. So even if we do get you on medications, you need higher doses, and it's just a lot harder to treat. So it, you know, that to me is, it's the flooding of the streets with fentanyl combined with this isolating time, and this prolonged isolating time is really causing this increase in overdoses in the last couple months. I think the thing that we need to focus, or one of the things that we need to focus on, is that we definitely need to get more Narcan out on the streets. We need to get it in more the hands of more people, and we need more of it in their hands. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about is, and I don't know if everybody here heard about it, but there was a shooting in a medical clinic in Buffalo, an Alina clinic, yesterday. And I just heard from the Star Tribune that one of the people that was injured actually died this morning. But if you read the most of the press closely, it was clear, and maybe it was clear as a physician reading through the lines, but it was clear that had to do with pain medicines. And he had threatened his physician before about pain medicines. So I think the pain medicine issue isn't going away either. And it creates really, you know, I've been in really difficult, scary situations. So I think, you know, I don't know what exactly we can do about that, but that has to be on our mind too, that's not going away either. So that being said, I'm going to talk about our council and what we've done over the past year and a half or so, and what we hope to accomplish in the coming years, I guess. So like Representative Baker said, we have a very diverse council. We have representation from two members of the public, one in recovery from opioid addiction and one with chronic pain. We have representatives from treatment programs, alternative pain management programs, the courts, the Department of Corrections, Dakota and Ojibwe tribes, representatives from the Ambulance and Hospital Association. We have two physicians, including myself, one representing the MMA and one representing the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine. We have a representative from a nonprofit that distributes naloxone. We have representatives from the Board of Pharmacy, the Minnesota Department of Health, Department of Human Services, and then two senators and two representatives. So it's a diverse council, and we've been meeting since about September 2019. And between September and March of 2020, we spent most of our time discussing kind of future focus. We had set up the council and created the bylaws and discussed all that too. But our main focus was discussing all the opportunities that all of these people in the room with, you know, all of these diverse experiences could come up with, and how we wanted to create opportunities to improve the situation. So we spent most of our time until March doing that. In about July, we realized that there was a budget shortfall. We were given a number of about $20 million that we had to create an RFP and work with. And what was actually collected was about around $13 million. And so because of that, we decided that instead of creating an RFP and going with the RFP that we had created, we were going to reappropriate funds to proven programs that had already been successful through the state opioid response awards. So we reappointed funds to those programs, and most of them were going to expire in September 2020. So we thought that was a good use of our funds given this budget shortfall. We wanted to continue their good work. I have some examples of what those programs include. They're a lot of rural places, so like St. Louis County treatment programs, a lot of education programs like ECHO programs, which are basically didactic sessions for providers to via a Zoom format. And they were focused on either women or Native Americans. A lot of programs in the Native American community, including the Native American Community Clinic, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and the Northwest Indian Community Development Center. Several programs that were focused on African Americans and one specifically that was focused on Somali Americans in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. And several programs that were meant to increase access to naloxone. So in the next year and our future goals, so because of the way that the funds are collected and the budget shortfall that we had in the previous year, we did decide to change our timeline so that we could know exactly how much money we had before we had to put out an RFP. And so we changed that so that because the funds are collected, we won't know how much funds are collected till July. So we will publish the RFP in September. The RFP categories will include prevention and education. So things like public prevention programs for youth and adults, overdose prevention and education, and then community campaigns to decrease stigma. The second category is training on treatment of opiate use disorder or opioid addiction. That would include things like training on medications, these ECHO programs, resiliency programs for the current workforce in substance use disorder, expansion of the current workforce in substance use disorder, and then increasing access to specialty care. The third category is expanding and enhancing the continuum of care for opioid use disorder. And that would be things like increasing access to treatment for youth in schools. So actually bringing treatment into the school, which has a great proven record. Increasing access of treatment to criminal justice involved individuals. Telehealth innovations, holistic pain treatments, supportive housing options, mental health care, and then just improving care coordination within substance use disorder treatment, because from a treatment perspective, treatment in Minnesota is still very siloed. You have this treatment program, and then you transition to this treatment program, and you have this physician, and then you transition to this physician. So just sort of some sort of program that would help kind of smooth all those transitions. And then the fourth category is measures to protect the ability of those who need pain medicines to maintain their quality of life. And so those would be things like increasing access to holistic pain treatments. So that is sort of our future directions, what we've accomplished, what we want to do going forward, and kind of some of the stumbling blocks along the road that we've had to overcome. Unless there's any questions for me, I want to turn it over to Representative Cagle, and she can talk about some of the policy objectives that we've talked about that the council is supporting in this year and in the coming years. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dr. Pilkus. Appreciate it. I do see a hand up. We'll take a question at this point. Representative Thompson, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have kind of a question and a comment. Lo and behold, rest his soul, man. I have several friends who, a couple of them were in car accidents, these stories that they tell me. Car accidents, basketball players, athletes, who hurt themselves and were prescribed. Here I am, 40 some years old. I'm talking about like these guys look like they're 60 years old. And you know, so a couple of my friends passed away, overdose off of not opioids, these pain meds. Problem I was having was a couple of them were trying to get help. They were trying to get into facilities, treatment, and the red tape. It was almost virtually impossible to get them into treatment, and a couple of them lost their lives. So when we talk about, you know, opioids in the African-American community, it's almost bringing me to tears because I lost a couple of friends. I'm sorry. I lost a couple of friends who lost their lives overdosing off of opioids that were prescribed to them by their doctor. The doctor wound up just taking them off. You know, some of them had other drugs in their system, like marijuana. And so the doctor said, well, if you got caught with marijuana in your system, we have to take you off of this drug and you can't get it. But their body needed that drug. Some of my friends also drugged to ease the pain of some of the things that they were experiencing in their life. And I always used to say to them, like, man, When the high wears down, you still have the same problem. I need you to get into help. I lost a couple of friends. And so this is like, sorry guys. This is near and dear to me. I know people who need help right now. And they're having a hard time getting into treatment facilities. So much red tape. They almost have to be half dead. It has to be an emergency. Why do we have to wait? Why do people have to wait until they're almost like at the rock bottom to get the help that we need in our communities? And so I'm sorry if I got a little...
That's all right, Representative Thompson. This is, wow. You know, these are tough issues, and it's good that you're able to share and let us know what you're seeing and what you're hearing out there. Please go ahead and continue.
I want to be able to bring back to people that it's not your fault. And addiction is a disease. I want to be able to bring help to people in our community who need the help. And it's so hard getting people into these treatment facilities. It's virtually impossible. with all the red tape. And so just, I know that legislation helped create a lot of the problems that we have, and legislation can help fix it. So I just want to, like, thank you guys, all of you, for the work you're doing in this field. And thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Representative Thompson, for sharing with us and highlighting some of the issues that people are still facing out there. I'm not seeing any other questions. I'm wondering, maybe this would be a good time for Representative Cagle to see if some recommendations are going to help start getting at some of the issues that Representative Thompson had raised. So, Representative Cagle, if you'd like to go ahead and start, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so through this process, you know, we saw some public or some policy recommendations that would help help exactly what Representative Thompson was talking about, get people into treatment, get people help, and, you know, reduce the stigma. So some of the things that we've been looking at, so we came up with a very large list of priorities with different public policy items that we could work on. And then, you know, our world changed in March. And so we really kind of whittled down our list of the 2021 policy priorities that we had. And so these are just a few of the bills that we are working on right now. And also some of them, you know, are kind of part of a bigger picture too. And so Representative Morrison has House File 19, and currently, and I might get this completely wrong. So Dr. Pilkus, if I missed up this one, I have a hard time understanding this whole process as far as reimbursements and things like that. And so what the buy and bill would do is reform reimbursement to providers who are using injectable formats of medicated assisted treatment like Vivitrol. And so currently the practitioner kind of has to maintain their own supply of these medications, and it makes it really difficult for them to, it's kind of cost prohibitive. So the provider has to pay for them, keep them in stock, and then once they are able to administer them to a patient, then they can file for the reimbursement. And so what we're just asking is that the reimbursement come when they acquire the medication. We're also working to clarify some language around needles and who and paraphernalia around who is able to have needles and syringes. So one of the things that in our laws classifies needles and syringes as paraphernalia, even without any drug residue in them. And so some of the Narcan kits are needles and syringes. And so when you're trying to administer life-saving drugs, but you're not allowed to carry the delivery method of those life-saving drugs, it can be, you know, we need to make sure that people aren't getting in trouble for having these needles. And through some of these discussions, we also found that it was illegal to carry fentanyl testing strips as well, because there's some statutes about being able to test purity of a controlled substance. And so that's something that we're addressing through some of these statutory changes around needles and paraphernalia. Reimbursement for alternative pain medicine, that was one that's on our 2021 list, but might have to be put off for a little bit so that we can figure out how to best, you know, get that reimbursement reform in a challenging budget year. I think that might be a heavy lift. A bill that I actually, that's going to be heard today in Commerce is urine drug screening limits. Currently, there are some health plans limit the number of drug screenings to 12 per year, there's limits on some of the urinalysis testing that they can do. And so what we're asking is that there's no limit on urine analysis screenings for opioids, or the limit is at least is one per day, and so that we can really make sure that, you know, people are getting the testing that they need when they're in treatment and recovery. I know when my brother was in treatment and recovery, he had urine analysis screenings quite often. telemedicine reimbursement. We've seen this, you know, because of COVID, we've been able to kind of transition a lot of our telemedicine reimbursements or doctor's appointments and treatment and things like that to telemedicine or virtual care. And so we'd really like to see that permanent. We also realize, though, that there's a broadband issue. And so one of the things that the council is also supporting is border-to-border broadband so that people who are in rural areas or, you know, have transportation issues or things along those lines are able to actually, you know, call in or, you know, hop on the internet and do that. Another bill that will be heard this afternoon in commerce is life insurance reform. So when we did our first traveling session, the council had one of our meetings out on the White Earth Reservation. And one of the things that was brought up there is that, you know, family members of people who have substance use disorders or opiate use disorders would get prescriptions for Narcan. And so that if something were to happen in their household, they would be able to, you know, save their loved one's life. But we were hearing that their life insurance policies were being canceled because of those prescriptions. And so I've been working with the insurance industry, and this is something that they support. This has happened in other states that life insurance cannot be canceled or they can't deny you coverage because of a opioid antagonist prescription. Representative Baker is also working on some suggestions that came to us from DOC about prohibiting revocation of someone's probation or supervised release due to drug use alone. And so we've been working closely together on that bill with the Department of Corrections and really hoping that we can you know, instead of continuing to punish somebody for their disease, that we, you know, want to make sure that they're getting the help that they need. We also have a very big list of 2022 kind of forward-looking legislation, and we really kind of put them down into categories of treating opioid use disorder intervention and connections, addressing the needs of criminal justice involved people, prescribing tools, patient education, alternative pain, prevention, preventing overdoses, and some reimbursement reforms. And so there's some things that we're working on. Like I have a bill that for reimbursement reform for addiction coaches, medicine counselors, and recovery coaches. Representative Edelson is working on a study for licensing and regulating sober living facilities, and Representative Baker and Representative Frankie and I have been involved in that. I'm also working on some, one of the things we heard from our Department of Corrections people on the council was just kind of the lack of continuing care when somebody is released from prison to the aftercare. So I've been working with the Department of Corrections on, you know, making sure that they have housing, that they have their health insurance covered. And that's something that actually the Senate, I believe Senator, I can't remember, I'm sorry. But the Department of Corrections has been working with one of the senators. And so came to me and I was like, this is great. This is exactly what we're talking about in the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Committee. So those are just some of the things that we're looking towards 2022 at. You know, we also looked at the Minnesota Student Survey and how we can, you know, get more accurate data from that. You know, reimbursement reform for alternative pain medicine. I think I remember mentioned that. So those are just some of the issues that we're working on towards 2022. But with those hopefully those 2021 ones we can get past this year and really start to make a difference. So with that, I will put myself back on mute.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Thank you, everybody, for the information that you've all provided today. The work that you folks are doing on the council is great. I'm happy to see it. I see several hands going up. We will start with Representative Franke. Representative Franke, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. First, I want to start off by thanking Representative Cagle and Representative Baker and everybody on the ORC Council for all the great work they're doing. This whole presentation just, you know, reiterates everything that we're seeing and we've been talking about. I mean, between us about addiction and mental health issues going forward out of this pandemic and the work that we're going to have to accomplish. I have a brief question for Dr. Pilkus, if she would.
Yes, go ahead. I'm here. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Pilkus, for your passion in this area. I'm just wondering, and I guess this is kind of a rhetorical question, but with the synthetic opioids, we know that the addiction stranglehold is, you know, harder. And what is the time frame? I mean, compared to, you know, back in the day when things weren't synthetic and manufactured to be stronger, what are we looking at now as far as your initial recovery rate in a length of time? I mean, versus coming off of even just the pills or, I hate to even say it this way, just regular heroin. It just blows my mind to even say a statement like that. But how long is that taking? Because I think sometimes we need to take into account when we're drafting policy and making decisions that these things are going to take longer. It takes longer to readjust. I know when I change things in my life, I always talk about and tell people it took a couple of years. I mean, I feel looking back, you know, years later that my brain chemistry wasn't even functioning right. And what are we seeing compared to how it was before to where we're at now with these synthetics? Thank you.
Dr. Pilkus.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair Fisher. And thank you, Representative Franke, for the question. And if I'm correct, I think the question was, because the opioids that we're dealing with right now are so much stronger, does it take longer to achieve recovery? Is that the question?
Yes, pretty much.
I think it's harder to get stabilized on medications, and that might take longer because it's so much stronger. But recovery and sort of returning to, like you said, sort of normal brain chemistry is such a personal journey. It's really hard to say, you know, when that happens for anyone. And I don't think it necessarily takes longer with stronger opioids. I think, like I said, I think it's a personal journey. But we always tell people, you know, don't, because we use medications. And so we always tell them, like, don't even think about trying to come off of these medications for at least a year. Give yourself a year. Give yourself time to sort of get things in order, get your basic needs in order. Because people always want to come and say, they always want to say, okay, but I want to be off these medications in 6 weeks. And, you know, I think what we need to reiterate is addiction is a chronic disease. And it's about management and it's about long-term management. And anybody who's known anybody or experienced addiction knows that it's a sneaky, you know, a sneaky thing, and it can come back when you least expect it. And so recovery and addiction are, they're long-term disease. It's a long-term disease. So to answer your question, I think it does take a little bit longer, you know, maybe weeks longer to get stabilized on medications because the drugs are so much stronger, but the recovery process is still years.
Right. I guess maybe sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I could have framed that a lot quicker. Have you seen your prescribing methods, you know, initially taking, you know, going a little bit longer than normally would have, you know what I mean, because of the type of synthetics they may be on.
I don't think it's longer. I think it's stronger. We have to have higher doses. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pilkus and Representative Franke. Next, we'll go to Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to thank Representative Baker and Representative Cagle and everyone who's presented today. And just for your work with this council, it's heartbreaking and hopeful at the same time. So I just want to thank you for your work. My question is for Dr. Pilkus as well, but others can jump in. I have a question. You mentioned briefly the program with the Somali community in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. And I recently had some leaders in this East African community reach out to me to talk with me about this issue, very concerned about the opioid epidemic in their communities. It's clear the losses are extremely painful, of course, but they're also sharing that there's confusion in their community about, you know, exactly what's happening to their youth, and which is, you know, completely understandable. And so they were talking about the need for more culturally specific programming and responses. So I'm wondering if you could say more about the program in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, and if there are conversations happening in the council about how to deepen this outreach with the East African community, and how to be responding and building on the successes of the program in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood.
Dr. Pilkus?
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Lippert. I think Representatives Baker and Cagle can help me with this question, but what I know about Alliance Wellness, which is the program in the Somali community, is that it's it is a medication-assisted therapy program. And it includes behavioral treatment as well. It's owned by a Somali American person, and I do know that they do quite a bit of outreach into that community. But but we've also definitely heard that there is, you know, because we're dealing with a first generation immigrants who still have, but the community leaders are still immigrants. And so I think there's this giant gap in understanding. And so we have discussed how we can have more culturally specific and support more culturally specific programs in that specific community and through a granting process. Through our granting process. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Representatives Baker and Cagle and see if they have anything to add.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Baker, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lippert, that's a really good question. I've been working a lot with the East African community, not only in my own area, but here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. There is a real disconnect with the religious belief of what is addiction. They don't understand this, and we have to be very, very careful to walk through that process with them in order to really recognize what this disease of addiction is. Our East African community does not understand this is a disease. They don't understand what it's doing to the brain. They just know that it's wrong, and they look at it differently. So we are really starting up a brand new kind of programs with those communities to help them understand what does drugs do on your brain. A lot of us remember the old videos when the fried egg was going on, and this is your brain on drugs. We have to kind of bring that community along as quickly as we can. They're losing people and they don't know why. So we are actually working really hard right now. I'm working with meetings through Isaiah and community leaders here in the metro, also starting up some support groups in rural Minnesota to just start families to get together to talk about what is addiction and how can we help our loved ones without being shamed. That is the biggest thing we all deal with addiction, is the shaming of this disease and the stigma that it has for many, many, many years. We've got to work through that, but we are, that's one of our highest priorities, Representative Lippert, and I think that it's certainly something for me that's near and dear because it's actually in my district as well, and we need to get people to understand this better. So, and again, our expert from MDH, Mr. Farley, might have something to say about this too.
I see Mr. Farley's hand up. We'll go to Mr. Farley at this point.
Chairman Fisher, Representative Lippert, happy to talk to you also offline. Minnesota Department of Health has a grant from the CDC. We do have a grant with Alliance Wellness to do some overdose fatality reviews. And so although the data I presented today, it was quantitative data, one of the things, as is mentioned, is having a better cultural understanding or what's happening specifically in communities. And overdose fatality reviews is one mechanism to take a look at what's happening in a specific community. We have worked with Native American communities, and it's both a review to take a look at what are some of the gaps, but it also can be a healing process for the community to take a look at what's happening, and it's done in a respectful way, and hopefully then at the end of these reviews, we can take a look what are some might be some gaps in services or handoff. The other thing I would say is we have done some training with imams in the Muslim community there in Cedar Riverside area to say exactly what Representative Baker was, is having a different understanding of what, how they see this, how they see health, how they see wellness, how they see disease and out of balance. And so working with them, and happy to talk later about these efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farley. And one of the things, and I appreciate you hitting on it, Mr. Farley, this will be back to the rest of the presenters here, is we've been talking about the Somali and East African population. And as I look at the charts that were presented, I noticed that even more so in the indigenous population here in our state, that those death disparities in the deaths is extremely off the charts. And we've heard some great things are being done in the different populations. Are there specific programs, and what are the success rates, and what's happening with folks in the indigenous population? Who'd like to try to answer that one?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Baker.
I can tell you that I have recently sat on an evaluator process of actually going through some of the grant applications from the federal funds that have come through to the state of Minnesota. And I will tell you right now, there's a number of programs that are being initiated up in the Bemidji area, northern Minnesota. They're trying to really recognize that population as having a high need. They're starting up programs fairly quickly. It's not enough, and it's a big part of getting through to the way they heal is differently in Native American communities than it is the white Caucasian and other places. So we're trying to do it to their cultural specific ways of healing, but there are actually up and coming, I know Sanford and Health and the University of Minnesota, and there's others out there trying to reach out, and there's new programs that are getting set up because of the federal and state action that's happening. So I think help is on the way. It's not fast enough, and we're trying to get to them as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Baker. And I know we're coming up on 9:30, so I don't see any other hands up. So first of all, I want to thank everybody for the work that they've been doing on the councils. Thank you to also Representative Baker for your commitment over the years on it, Representative Cagle. And at this point in time, we're going to look forward to the legislation coming forward to our committee here. And with that, we will move on to the next part of our agenda. So once again, thank you everyone for being involved. You're welcome. The next agenda item will be reviewing a proposal from the governor's budget recommendations that better aligns service standards for mental health professionals across fields and across state statutes. An earlier version of this proposal was included in the House HHS budget bill in 2019, but there has been further collaboration with stakeholders and refinements to that language since that time. So while we are still waiting for the jackets to be completed, I do intend for the division to hear the official bill once it is ready. We've asked the DHS to kindly review with us the draft language. And so we do have the draft language that was out there today for us to start vetting it. This draft language is not necessarily the final product, but my understanding that it is close enough that we can start a productive conversation today. For members of the public watching this morning, you'll find the language on the committee website, and it is titled Reviser Draft 21-00216. And we will start the presentation at this time. And once the presentation is done, we'll take questions after we're done hearing from our presenters. With that, my understanding, the first person that we're going to be having present to us today, I believe, is Mr. Ashley Wortman from the Department of Human Services. Am I correct on that?
Yes, thank you. My name is Ben Ashley Wortman from DHS. Thank you, Chair Fisher and members, for your time today learning about uniform service standards. Christy, or do we have the slide deck available? You can go to the second slide. If you can advance, yep, one slide. In 2017, providers asked us to address excessive paperwork in mental health services. There were a lot of possibilities about what that might mean. We did some research on it, and the resulting answer was everything. Since those initial interviews, stakeholders have been at the heart of uniform service standards. We asked people to join monthly half-day-long meetings to help us wade through the details, more than double the number that would fit in the room volunteered. We've held hours-long WebExes going section by section through the bill and reviewing impacts. Hundreds have attended. There have been compromises and certainly work remains, but we are where we are today because people have shown up. They've shown up to do the work and to create something better. I'm immensely grateful for that. Next slide. Today, I'm going to introduce a little background about USS, the values that animate the project. I'll give a high-level outline of the language, but most importantly, you'll hear from three folks who have participated as stakeholders and the pieces of USS that are particularly meaningful to them. Next slide, please. So what did we hear? We heard that we couldn't serve diverse communities when regulations are one-size-fits-all. We heard that time spent out complex and prescriptive regulations was a real and significant pressure on providers that hurt their ability to serve clients. We heard that we needed a unified structure that made sense for DHS and providers both. Next slide. These are paraphrases from some of our early engagement with culturally focused providers on this project. One major theme was the diagnostic assessment. This determines what condition a person might have and how it could be treated. Providers wanted more time to build common understanding. I know that this refugee has trauma, but there simply isn't a word for that concept in the language that we share. They wanted flexibility to make the process of seeking services culturally centered. Asking certain questions too soon, particularly to an elder, would be culturally offensive, turn a person off from seeking help. Taking time, meeting people where they're at, this is a good idea across the board, but wherever our regulations fall short, it will first be felt in communities experiencing disparities. Next slide. We frequently heard about requirements that didn't add value. They made service delivery difficult. And one of these was the approval of the treatment plan. Clinical trainees can draft a treatment plan with a client or family, but they need mental health professional to sign off. Right now, in CGSS services, a treatment plan is updated at least every 90 days. It's due immediately if there's a service after the 90-day mark. We had two unintended impacts. We can miss learning opportunities for feedback and correction. And the other is burnout. The pressure on supervisor and staff means long unpaid hours finishing documentation after a full day of seeing clients. We had supervisors tell us about bringing laptops to the beach because they couldn't ever step away from this without interrupting billing and services for their clients. Mental health professionals and clinical trainees are an extremely valuable resource and workforce. We need to address challenges to retain them. Next slide. The definition of who is a mental health professional should be easy and clear. There are six disciplines, each with their board of practice. Tribal authority to credential providers is also clear. And yet, we have 11 distinct definitions repeated a total of 47 different times over statute, rule, and actively used variances. all of them have mistakes. So multiply it out. How many different regulations for a clinical trainee, a practitioner, a treatment plan, record keeping, application process, approval from DHS? Quickly, you have a dizzying array of regulations, some of which openly contradict each other, that a provider is supposed to adhere to, and we at DHS need to provide guidance on. In the confusion, meaningless distinctions are elevated. They become silos out of small historical accidents, and meaningful distinctions are buried or overlooked. Next slide, please. This is a visual outline of how disparate and siloed services can be brought together with a common core of expectations. This doesn't have all the detail in the service lines that we're touching, but for the sake of understanding the process, I think it works quite well. We start with this year's work, but we'll continue to bring additional services in under a licensing framework. Licensing is helpful. We need the right tool for bad actors, but there are other far more important reasons to pursue this. When the work of approving and working with providers is organized in a single area, it opens up a significant possibility for providers. Reviews that are conducted broadly across program areas to minimize repeated visits from DHS, improve consistency in feedback, and clarity of expectations. Next slide, please. So, how do we get there? USS is a lot of language, if you've seen the revisor file. The first article is the core of the new standards. I'll note that much of the new language is in fact based on current requirements, but it's cleaned up. It's focused on the pieces that we really need. The language outline we provided as a handout has a little bit more detail than this, but we're happy to dive in even further wherever there is interest or concern. Article 2 is crisis services. This is more than just conforming changes to USS, but that's a major part of what's happening. We also have updates to the standards. They've been proposed before, but haven't yet passed. Major developments here are unifying adult and children's services, again, to reduce unintentional differences, and also a focus that a crisis affects more than just an individual. It can be a family. It can be neighbors and friends who are calling for help. Article 3 is conforming changes. We took out language wherever it wasn't needed anymore. There was now a standard in the core that could be referenced instead, a single place in statute. We corrected cross-references and clarified language that was unclear or confusing. And we'll have further opportunities to clean up those services as their specifics are brought into the 245i chapter, just like we did with ERTS, residential crisis, and Rule 29 clinics this time around. And with that, I'll hand it over to Abby, Brooke, and Jen, who will share a few highlights from their perspective.
Thank you. Next, we will be hearing from Ms. Abby Vavra, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and who you're with, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Abby Vavra, and I am the Public Policy and Compliance Counsel at Fraser. We are a nonprofit community mental health clinic that provides services to young children, children with autism, children on the adoption and permanency spectrum, and adults with co-occurring intellectual and mental illness. We strongly support the USS package. These changes are needed. Because there are so many elements in the package, we will send the committee written comments going into more detail on specific provisions, including a community letter with more than 15 agencies supporting the early childhood mental health updates. For today, we want the committee to know that we are particularly excited about the improvements to the diagnostic assessment and treatment planning standards, because we believe that these changes will help families access and sustain services. Given the amount of time we have, I would like to take the rest of my comments to share a personal story from a colleague of mine at Fraser. His name is Lucas Kunak, and he's currently the Director of Business Development. He formerly was our public policy strategist, meaning that he spent several years studying the state's mental health statutes and advocating with the legislature for improvements. He is one of our experts on the mental health rules in the state. And this is what he shared with me. After working in the mental health field for almost two decades, I happened to find myself needing to look for mental health services for my elementary age daughter. The entire process of finding and starting services was completely overwhelming. The most confusing and frustrating part as a parent was that the first several meetings were spent mostly on answering questions and filling out forms about things that didn't seem all that important. What we wanted was immediate help for our daughter, but instead we felt like we were spending time jumping through hoops. On one hand, because I was a professional insider, I knew exactly what lines in the regulations each question was coming from. On the other hand, it wasn't until about the fourth appointment that we felt like we were actually finally starting the treatment plan and getting the help that we were looking for. Overall, it was a frustrating and confusing process. Every clinician was doing fantastic work, but the system tied their hands. Our regulations forced them to spend more time checking boxes than giving specific help that we were looking for. It took a lot of perseverance to make it through the initial phase and stay engaged in services. It was an eye-opening experience that helped me better understand just how challenging our system makes it for our families who have fewer resources and face more hurdles, including our BIPOC families. So with those comments, I want to reiterate that Fraser is excited about the USS project. We think it will allow our clinicians to take more time at the start on addressing families' immediate needs rather than on completing paperwork. This will ultimately result in more families engaging in services that will make a long-term difference in their lives. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Barbara. Next, we have Brooke Schultz. If you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Yes. Thank you so much for hearing me today. My name is Brooke Schultz. Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the Minnesota House Behavioral Health Policy Division. I'm the Associate Director of Clinical Services for Radius Health. We're a nonprofit organization that provides a spectrum of community-based mental health services throughout the metro area. We serve more than 7,000 people a year, and we're also members of the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota, or MHPAM. So thank you for the opportunity to speak from a provider perspective about this, this Minnesota Mental Health Uniform Service Standards proposal. I've been pretty active in this process over the last 2 years. As you've heard from other testifiers, it's been very valuable to have stakeholders from various groups, the Department of Human Services, our regulators, providers, advocacy. We've all come together to try to work on this proposal to have the shared end goal of improving access to services for Minnesotans. And as a group, it's been frankly fun to work together to review and revise the currently unnecessarily complex, conflicting, and very confusing current system of rules and regulations that govern our services. I've been particularly involved in the portion of the bill that's focused on mental health services in the intensive residential treatment services programs. The proposed regulations for these intensive residential treatment services will be very helpful to providers, but more importantly to persons served. They'll result in increased clarity for providers. They'll result in much more flexibility for paperwork timelines that will really allow for persons served and treatment professionals working with them to build a relationship before having to dig into the treatment that happens in such a short period of time. The beginning of a stay in a treatment program can oftentimes be overwhelming, so spacing out some of the standards around treatment requirements and assessment requirements will help everybody, treatment team members, and more importantly, again, the person served. Additionally, the proposal includes new discharge standards for situations where the programs decide to initiate a discharge process. This process can be very confusing for all parties involved. So these clear and specific requirements for these discharges will help folks served and providers to decrease confusion and uncertainty. And more importantly, will also help everybody to try to help track and improve outcomes, determine whether there are disparities that are involved in these processes and what can we do to reduce them. Again, the discussions amongst the stakeholders have been meaningful, and the diverse perspectives have been reviewed by providers, advocates, and regulators until we've been able to find a consensus position. We're in alignment about what's being proposed, and we're excited about moving forward with some of these better access to high-quality mental health services. So thank you for the time today to be able to have a conversation about this topic. I realize that regulatory details and processes are not exciting, not the most exciting of legislative reforms, but they do truly impact the experience of Minnesotans navigating the mental health service system. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Appreciate that. We'll be taking questions here after we have our last presenter. Next, we have Jenny Palin. If you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself, who you're with, and start your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. My name is Jinlee Palin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We are a state association of 33 community-based mental and chemical health providers across Minnesota. As most of our folks are deemed essential community providers, we are a really, I think, core piece of the safety net program for folks who otherwise would not have access to community-based mental and chemical health services across the state. We have also been very active and directly involved in the USS process for the last probably 3 years now we're going on. And we're similar to the folks who have presented before me and some of my colleagues. We are also very excited with the work that has been happening and look forward to continuing this process through the session. I'm here to speak a little bit about the updates to the current Rule 29 standards and also to moving into a unified licensing framework. We're really seeing some great value in this direction of moving into a unified licensing framework. As the testifiers before me have stated, the current system really mandates that providers spend a great deal of time tracking down various pieces of statute, rule, or variances just to determine which regulations apply to our services. They have to spend a lot of time interpreting those often confusing regulations and then taking extra time to follow up with the correct regulatory agencies on how to proceed when some of those regulations conflict with each other. This is all time taken away from providers' time and capacity to deliver high quality mental health services to our clients and to our communities. Our hope is that by moving into a unified licensing framework for these services, providers will have more transparency and a uniform system of standards to operate within that'll better support our collective goals of increasing access to high quality care. Clear accountability across all partners in the mental health service continuum so that everyone understands who is responsible for what, and we all are playing by the same rule book, if you will. This would include the providers, the counties, and the state. Greater consistency and guidance given to our providers, and more transparency for everyone in the process for reporting and investigations of complaints, including abuse, neglect, or maltreatment. Within this uniform framework broadly that USS is moving into, there's a specific area with Rule 29 or certified mental health clinics. The goals of the mental health clinic and the benefit is that it offers a comprehensive set of services and care from a multidisciplinary team. However, under the current standards for Rule 29 certification, the mandates are very time consuming with a lot of administrative burden, again, taking away time and capacity from providing services. USS would offer some really great first steps in aligning certification and operating standards for certified community mental health providers. We believe this will streamline and update the comprehensive set of care provided. Some examples here, offering clinics some ability to tailor the quality assurance and improvement program requirements to their specific needs, and providing some flexibility for maintaining staff support across numerous sites of an agency, especially in this workforce shortage that we're experiencing. As stated in this slide, we know that this is just a first step in this larger reform. We look forward to next steps and further refining and defining what community mental health services are and working towards streamlining the administrative requirements and regulatory reviews within their scope and care. I would also echo the points that testifiers ahead of me had made, and that this really has been a collaborative process for the last 2 years between the department, the providers, and mental health advocates who have been working on this proposal. We believe that this moves us toward our shared goal of increasing access to high quality mental health services, and we look forward to continued collaboration as the bill continues to be revised as it moves through this legislative process. Thank you so much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Palin. Appreciate it. Appreciate everyone making the presentation here and all the work that you folks have been doing over the last couple of years to pull this all together. One of the questions I have, and I don't know who's best to address it, is that one of the things that I've seen in the physical health system is that sometimes there's not a real good handoff between what I would call the pediatric side, those who are under 18, to those who are over 18. And I know that So often in statute, we've had different ways you treat people who are under 18, the regulations, and then when you start going over 18, things change a little bit. So how did you folks take a look at what are looked at to make sure that is as seamless as possible as people, quote unquote, age out of one system and into the other system?
Chair Fisher, I can answer this.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Ashley Worthman.
Thank you. So certainly this is a really important balancing act. Yeah. On the one hand, we want the uniformity wherever we can get it and make it easier to move from system to system. On the other hand, we heard very clearly about the places where children's services are unique, need to be unique, that understanding developmental stages is a key portion of doing the work well. I think some of the examples that you could look at are the training standards. We have very common training standards across all of the different services, but then we've specifically called out a unique set of requirements for folks who are working with children. And so treatment plans would be another. Again, we've created greater consistency in this proposal than we've seen in the past, but certainly, especially in some of the intensive children's services, we're still looking for more frequency of updates simply because that's clinically appropriate.
Okay, thank you, sir. I appreciate hearing that. I appreciate the sensitivity, and I know things are very different from under 18 to over 18, then there's some unique challenges that are in there. I appreciate the fact that you folks are looking at that and trying to get as much consistency so that we have a very good handoff as we go forward. One of the questions I have, well, I shouldn't say one of the questions, what I want to do is also make sure to give anyone else on the committee a chance to ask questions. We do have a couple of more minutes here. If anybody does have questions, I'm seeing Representative Frankie. Representative Frankie, go ahead, sir. You're
thank,
on.
Yep, got
there
it.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I just want to thank all the presenters today. Obviously, this is a lot of information going over the bill, 220-some pages, and besides the handouts, I see a lot of positive movement in these policy initiatives. You know, whatever we can do, my concern is, you know, the treatment and recovery, whatever it may be, mental health issues, addiction for people, and how do we streamline that process? And like you said, the transitions, that's one of the things I've always talked about, is how do we transition? And you brought up a good point, Mr. Chair, about the aging out. I mean, we hear about that all the time, whether it's in, you know, a mental health capacity or just an age capacity. And so moving forward, you know, there's a lot of stuff we're going to have to go over. I look forward to the process. I see a lot of good things in here from everything that I've read so far. I do have some concerns. You know, we always have to try to have forward looking, worried about unintended consequences and how do we kind of head those off the pass. So I'll just end by thanking everybody for their hard work. I mean, it looks like there is so much here that has been done by everyone, the agencies and all the organizations that are involved to try and streamline this, because this is one thing we've talked about, is how do we provide these services in a better manner. So I look forward to the discussion, and I want to thank everybody, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Frankie, and I want to open up to everybody is that I know that on the parts that we were just hearing about right now, those jackets will be coming to me. So people have ideas, thoughts, concerns, make sure to please reach out to me, reach out to somebody in the department. It's something that we're looking forward to help streamline things, make the system work better, and make sure that we're getting better end results as we're going forward today. I am not seeing any other questions at this point in time. I also want to remind people that we will be seeing language coming forward, bills coming forward from Representative Baker and Cagle on what the council was recommending on the opioids, and would encourage people who are interested to make sure as those come out to sign on as a way to support the bills as we go forward. Same with the bill that we'll be having coming from the department. Once again, I want to thank everybody who presented today. It was incredible information that we heard from the council, what's happening there, the work that's being done there. Great to, and I very much appreciate hearing from the Department of Human Services being willing to share with us early the language so that we can start getting to some of this stuff, seeing where things may be, start getting the questions out there so that we can make this as smooth as possible. This is one of those areas where I believe there's a lot of great bipartisan work. We've got a lot of great people on the committee here, and we look forward to continue to working together as we move these issues forward. With that, I want to say as a quick reminder to everyone in the public that we'll continue to accept written testimony on today's agenda. So if anyone in the public has any comments on anything they heard in either presentation, please forward to us. It will become part of the record. It will go out to the committee, and we'll also be posting it on the website. And you'll have 24 hours to be able to get that into us. Once again, thank you, everybody. And with that, we are adjourned.